From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, state lawmakers say they're working on improving Massachusetts' sex offender registry after an audit could not account for more than 1,700 offenders.
Sex Offender Registry Board in Massachusetts is kind of a freestanding entity. It is not based in a law enforcement agency as it is in most other states.
Also, we talk with a Harvard history professor about his MacArthur Genius Award for research on migration and the lessons still relevant today.
One of the big lessons is really that migration affects a far larger number of people than those who are migrants themselves.
Plus, Cambridge author Alice Hoffman on her new book, which is a prequel to Practical Magic.
Belladonna. It's a sedative. People put it in their tea to relax, calm their nerves.
Some people also use it as a poison.
Which people?
Which people?
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. State lawmakers are looking at how to better keep track of the estimated 22,000 sex offenders in Massachusetts. They held a hearing this week on a report by the state auditor, which found that the state did not have addresses for more than 1,700 sex offenders who were supposed to be registered with the Sex Offender Registry Board. Here's Public Safety Secretary Dan Bennett, whose office oversees the board.
We are not out there looking for sex offenders. Police do the investigation, and it's a good thing because there's 25,000 of them.
But State Auditor Suzanne Bump says the public is at risk because people don't know if potentially dangerous sex offenders are living in their communities. She told lawmakers this week that the board, which she calls SORB, for Sex Offender Registry Board, needs to do more to track offenders.
SORB is not like the Registry of Motor Vehicles, passively taking information from compliant individuals. It has a statutory responsibility to ensure that the information is kept up to date, that it's accurate, and that it's secure.
Joining us to talk further about this is UMass Lowell criminology professor Andrew Harris. He's studying sex offender registries across the country. He says Massachusetts is different from other states in a couple of ways, namely in the way it classifies offenders and in how the board is structured.
So Massachusetts has what's called a risk assessment-based system, and the Sex Offender Registry Board has a process that they have to look at the totality of the case and look at a whole range of factors. And a lot of the risk assessment system that's been set up in Massachusetts is largely because it was circumscribed by the SJC.
So the auditor essentially says that the Sex Offender Board doesn't have addresses for more than 1,700 people and has been operating in a culture of passivity. The state public safety secretary testifies before the legislature and says enforcing sex offender registries really should be up to local police, and the onus is sort of on the offender who is supposed to be registering. So how is the board supposed to work, and why do you think we're facing this problem?
One of the organizational challenges we face is that the Sex Offender Registry Board in Massachusetts is kind of a freestanding entity. It is under the Secretary of Public Safety, but it is not based in a law enforcement agency as it is in most other states. The vast majority of other states have it situated most typically within the state police. But Massachusetts, I don't know if it's the only one, but it is probably one of only a handful, if it's not the only one, of places where the entity is its own freestanding thing. And that creates all sorts of issues around accountability. And
it essentially has no enforcement powers then.
Well, right. And it's kind of all devolved to the local jurisdiction. And that's not, it's not unusual to have local police. And in many states, actually, it's usually the sheriff. But it's not unusual to have that kind of decentralized activity taking place. But to have a state police agency, a state public safety agency with resources behind it, that is very often providing support to the locals, is something that we don't have in Massachusetts.
Is this a public safety threat?
It's difficult to evaluate that in a really straightforward way without knowing more about what is behind some of these gaps in the data. Because on some level, it may just be purely administrative. In other words, if you were to say, okay, this one person, we don't know exactly where he is, very often it's very easy to track that person down. Then you've got other cases that you would put more into kind of the offender noncompliance bucket. And the offender noncompliance bucket, that is very often cause for concern because that's somebody who's deliberately decided to not comply with the terms of the registration.
Mm-hmm. And
it's, I think it's important to separate those two things out.
But essentially, in this case, we don't really know.
That's correct. Right. And so without knowing that, it's very difficult to evaluate in which cases there would be a more elevated public safety risk.
Mm. Now, how common is it for states to have these kinds of issues with tracking people? And what are some states that seem to be doing it well?
It's not uncommon for there to be gaps in the data and gaps in what's going on. And part of it is the fact that as sex offender registration systems have expanded, what we've done is we've kind of thrown in the higher risk and the lower risk and the medium risk all into kind of like one bucket. And to the extent that systems are not capable of making those distinctions and therefore not capable of calibrating enforcement efforts and resources towards that risk, it's going to create more of those kinds of problems. And so, you know, one way I would just characterize this is we may be just simply looking at systems that are overloaded.
What do we know about the effects of registering and who benefits and who doesn't?
This has been a pretty controversial issue. And we've spent a lot of time talking to law enforcement about how they use and think about registry information. And I think if we think about registries as opposed to being something that's going to fix everything, if we think about it as part of a broader sex offender management system, I think it actually does have some utility.
Okay. Andy Harris is a professor at UMass Lowell and is leading a study of the sex offender registry and notification systems around the country. Andy, thanks very much for being with us.
Sure. Absolutely.
The business of self-driving cars is already paying off for a local company. Global auto parts supplier Delphi is acquiring Cambridge-based Newtonomy for roughly $450 million. The deal allows the driverless car company to scale up more quickly on a global level. A key component of the deal is the city-state of Singapore, where both Delphi and Newtonomy are testing their autonomous vehicles. WBUR reporter Asma Khalid has the story.
Under this deal, the number of employees at Delphi working on self-driving cars will roughly double to 200. Glenn DeVos, the chief technology officer at Delphi, says to win this market, the company has to move fast.
The acquisition of Autonomy and bringing them in really helps us accelerate our scale and our expansion of capabilities.
This purchase helps Delphi add new customers and new intellectual property in an emerging market. Delphi has snapped up other self-driving startups and, for now, insists this latest purchase will keep Newtonomy relatively intact.
Fundamentally, Newtonomy will remain an independent entity headquartered out of Boston.
And that means Newtonomy will continue its partnership with the ride-hailing company Lyft. And it still hopes to have a commercial self-driving taxi service on the road by the end of 2018. But if Newtonomy is successful in getting the world's first robot taxi fleet off the ground, it won't be here in Boston. It'll be in Singapore. Newtonomy's co-founder and CEO, Carl Yanyama, has described Singapore as a key part of Newtonomy's history.
We realized that it was worth the cost to go halfway around the world to be able to reap these benefits of being in a place that's just, we believe, the best place in the world to develop driverless car technology today.
Newtonomy spun out of an MIT Singapore research partnership. And nowadays, Singapore is known as a leader in the autonomous vehicle space. The infrastructure is shiny and new, plus the government has a stated mission to develop a car-light society.
You know, Singapore is not a very big country. They speak with one voice, and they have a clear idea of what their regulatory environment should look like.
And so, because the regulation is just easier to navigate, Singapore has become a test bed for Boston. Newtonomy has more cars on the road there and more engineers in the office.
My name is James Fu. I'm the Director of Technology in Newtonomy. We are currently in the Singapore office.
The Singapore office is a gray and purple warehouse.
You can see on the right side, we have the developers working on the algorithms. On the left side, these are the cars which are fully converted, modified, ready to go out for testing.
A garage door opens.
Oh.
And a white test car reverses. and screeches its way out onto the roads of Singapore. The Singaporean government recently expanded the size of its driverless car area. It's roughly the equivalent of the Seaport, the North End, Downtown, Beacon Hill, and Back Bay combined. Here in Boston, Nutanimi is only allowed to drive around a portion of the Seaport District. Nutanimi's engineers make the point that the more you drive, the smarter your self-driving car gets. And in Singapore, the cars have just been on the road longer. They're more experienced. Fu says the actual technology is identical, you know, minus the small software changes for left-hand versus right-hand driving. The big difference is the environment.
The kind of roads in Boston and Singapore is also very different. The climate is different. In Singapore, it doesn't snow. The driving behavior of other drivers is also very different.
Okay, obviously, Fu is being polite. We've all dealt with Boston drivers and understand what he's implying. But the Singapore-Boston testing isn't just about understanding two different ecosystems. Nutanimi CEO Yan Yema has often seen Singapore as a vision for something bigger.
We want to develop a technology that's globally applicable, that's not customized for a specific city or a specific country. The only way to do that is to be able to test every day in a diversity of environments.
With the Nutanimi acquisition, Delphi plans to have 60 autonomous cars across three continents by the end of the year.
That report from WBUR's Asma Khalid, lead reporter for our Bostonomics team covering innovation in the local economy. It's not uncommon for hundreds, sometimes millions, of people to leave their home countries and end up arriving in a very hostile place. Harvard history professor Sunil Amrith has been studying this, and this month he won a $625,000 MacArthur Genius Award for his work. Although Amrith's research focuses on migration in Southeast Asia in the 19th century, he says there are several lessons the U.S. can learn from this history. Professor Amrith, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So let's talk a little bit about your work and exactly what you have looked at, migration from India to Southeast Asia primarily, mm-hmm. right? And the award is for the body of work you've done, but that focuses on that specifically. What's the message that you, if there is a singular message or thread there from that period of time and that pattern of migration that you find so fascinating?
One message is that it was vast. There was as much migration in Asia as there was across the Atlantic, as there was in other parts of the world. And the message is really that Asia as we know it today, including the Asia that we think of as economically dynamic and really increasingly powerful in the world, was in many ways shaped in that moment by the massive movement of people, especially from India and China to Southeast Asia, but also within these regions as well. And my main interest is both in how this is universal, in the sense that this is the same sort of process that's going on in other parts of the world, including here in North America, and also in what is specific to that kind of migration within Asia, the ways in which, in fact, it may be quite different from the kinds of migration which people here are more familiar with.
Mm-hmm. And give me an example of a current day migration pattern that you think is very similar to what you've studied from this time.
Very similar is the enormous migration of migrant workers from South Asia to the Middle East, to places like Dubai and the Qatar and Saudi Arabia in the present day. And that involves several million people every year. And that's very similar to the kind of migration I'm talking about, because it's often relatively short-term circulating migration. The people come and go. They go abroad for periods of a few years or even longer than that, but with the idea that they will return home.
Mm-hmm. And what does history tell us about lessons to be learned about what happens to communities in migration, both those that are left behind and those that folks go to?
One of the big lessons is really that migration affects a far larger number of people than those who are migrants themselves. And so one of the things that's very interesting from my work, which I think is very resonant in contemporary times, is that there were places in South India where one in every two or three working age men at any given time were abroad in Southeast Asia. And you can imagine the multiplier effect that has on local communities. And that multiplier effect was particularly significant because people were coming and going. It was not that people would disappear, never to be heard from again. In fact, it was much more common for people to maintain their family connections back home, to come back for periods of time. And that itself was an engine of migration. Once you have uncles or brothers or cousins abroad, and then by the 20th century also sisters and aunts and wives, people tended to then cluster in those destinations. Mm-hmm. And so one of the lessons is really that migration can become something of a self-perpetuating sort of cycle, that certain places, certain families, certain villages become very outward oriented. And mm-hmm. I think one sees this in the world today. There are so many parts of the world where large numbers of people at any given time are overseas for work, temporarily or more permanently.
Mm-hmm. What about when the backdrop is something like what we're seeing right now in the United States, where there's animosity against outsiders? And of course, you know, what we're seeing in Myanmar, what do we know from history about what happens in those kinds of situations?
So unfortunately, there are many moments in history where this has happened. This has happened before. It's certainly hostility towards migration is a major theme in my work. One of the things I'm interested in exploring is what conditions allow for that hostility to emerge, to become a political force. And certainly the moment that most resembles our own, I think, is the 1930s. Not just the 1930s in Europe, which is a story everybody knows, but the 1930s in Asia, too. That was when you started to see, after a period of 30 or 40 years of massive expansion in migration, you see a backlash. You see a backlash, again, not dissimilar, at a moment of economic crisis. You see a backlash against migration across Southeast Asia during the Depression of the 1930s. And that was when, for the first time in Myanmar, for example, Burma as then was, there is a very sharp turn against Indian migration. Really, some of this has to do with fear and insecurity at a time of very rapid change and at a time of economic pressure on both migrant communities and host societies, and part of it has to do with new political ideologies. I mean, a lot of the ideologies of nationalism, which seem to be on the upsurge again in the world today, were very much a product of that moment in the early 20th century.
But what's happening in the U.S. right now, it's not economic pressure necessarily.
I think ideas are very powerful. Ideas which in the world today, of course, the media and social media in particular circulate with a rapidity which I don't think there's quite precedent for in the kind of in the time period that I work on. Ideas about others and strangers and the threats that they may pose to us, however we define that us. I mean, I do think that ideology is probably the main force at play in the United States today, but not just in the United States. Look at Myanmar. Right. Look at the Rohingya crisis there. So much of that is about the construction of the Rohingya as outsiders, as dangerous, as threatening. One sees traces of this in various historical moments of the past. I don't think one can ever reduce it to economic pressure or economic motivations.
And based on what you've studied, I know it's always hard to predict, but do you see, you know, really long-term damaging consequences from where we are in this country?
I do. I think the emboldening of that level of overt hostility to all sorts of communities and groups, migrants, some of them not migrants, will leave deep scars. I think will leave deep scars at the community level, but also at the national level, and indeed at the international level.
Let's talk about your award. What are you going to do? It's $625,000. What are you going to do with that?
I'm not going to go out and make any big purchases. I think some of this will feed into supporting the work that I'm already doing. It will make research travel easier. It will make it easier to get the kinds of support which make research easier. Some of it, I'm hoping, will really seed future projects, which I at the moment, I'm just finishing a book, and I'm nearly done writing it. So I think when I have finished that book, that will be a moment where I take stock.
Well, that's Harvard Professor Sunil Amrith, one of 24 winners of the 2017 MacArthur Genius Award. Thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And stay with us. Coming up, longtime Cambridge author Alice Hoffman brings us a story of witchcraft and romance. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. We're less than a week away from Halloween, which means it might be time to queue up those Halloween movies.
I am Newt, a toe of frog, will of bat, tongue of dog. Adder's fork and blind worm's sting. Barbados lime is just the best. Fraggers soft like a sailor's stubble. Flip the switch and let the cauldron bubble.
That's a scene from the 1998 film Practical Magic, starring Nicole Kidman and Sandra Bullock. It's based on the novel by longtime Cambridge resident Alice Hoffman. The book follows the Owens family, a clan of witches befallen by a curse that kills the one they love. Now, Hoffman's out with a prequel, and it's called The Rules of Magic. Alice Hoffman joins us in the studio to talk about this. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much.
So, Practical Magic came out 2 decades ago or so. When did you start thinking that you might need a prequel?
I always thought about it, and I readers sent me letters and emails, but I think I just felt like the time was right. And I did not want to go forward in time. I wanted to go back.
And why now? Any reason? Just the time right now to do the prequel, do you think?
You know, sometimes I feel like the writer's the last to know. And when I finished the book, I realized that there was this sense, it takes place during the 60s, which was when I grew up. And I think it's a really important time to look back to right now.
But why is that?
Well, I think all of the cultural changes that happened, all of the power of young people who made those changes, I think it's really important to look back at that now and remember what we can do.
And there's a lot of a family story there as well. You bring in a lot of events happening at that time, being drafted for military service, of course, is a big theme, and the Vietnam War and what was going on with that. But also family. What is it about families that you think, keeps creeping into your novels? What do you want to say about that?
Well, I think families are so interesting. They're such an interesting group of people just kind of thrown together. You know, you think you're going to know your family, but you don't really know who they are. And I always think it's so interesting that you cannot know your older relatives because you didn't know them when they were young.
And so they have these hidden stories.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Secrets.
That get passed down.
That's
many
true.
Times, right?
That is true. The ghosts in the nursery that, you know, they keep, these things keep affecting generation after generation after generation. And that's what really the curse is about. It's this sense that the family has passed this feeling about love down through the generations.
And how do you think families break that? Do they?
Well, therapy. I think time helps. I think facing it. You know, I think the real truth of this book is, you know, people are reminded that they have to be true to themselves and they have to be themselves. And I think that's the most important thing.
So the three children really who are the main characters in the book, Franny, Jet, and Vincent. Which one are you most like?
Oh, I'm not like any of them.
None of them.
Oh, no. You know, I started out as an escapist reader, and I am a completely escapist writer. So I'm not writing about people like myself. I may be writing about people I wish I was like, but they're not me.
What does it mean to be an escapist writer? How is it in your process then?
Well, I'll just give you an example. I was moving, and I was sitting in this living room filled with boxes and moving men. And the first thing I did was take out my computer and go inside a book. You know, so that's an escapist writer.
I know I read at one point that when you were writing Practical Magic, you wrote it in a garden shed on Cape Cod.
Yeah.
Where did you go for this book?
For this book, I was on my couch, I have to say. Nowadays, it really doesn't matter where I write. I feel like I can write anywhere. But then I think I felt like I needed to kind of escape physically. Now I really can write anywhere.
What's the difference, do you think? What changed?
I think I've been doing it for such a long time. It's such a part of my life. I don't understand what people who don't do it think about on their off hours. I mean, I can be standing online for a cup of coffee and I'm in my book.
Yeah. And so is it difficult? I mean, is it difficult for you sometimes to kind of, I guess, structure and have boundaries, right? And I think that's got to, that's probably why a lot of people don't do it. Right?
Probably. I mean, I have much more trouble with real life than book life. So for me, it's a pleasure to be inside a book.
Yeah. Yeah. You started this book with Once Upon a Time.
Yes.
Well, with this sort of fairy tale like quality. Was that what you were trying for?
It's what I was trying for. I mean, I fell in love with literature through fairy tales. I mean, that was my original reading, was fairy tales and myth and folk tales and stories my grandmother told me. And for me, that is the beginning of literature, is magic and words together. Mm.
You know, I wonder if you might read an excerpt.
Sure. Yeah. No, I'd love to.
There's a part here in the book where Franny, Jet, and Vincent are discovering who they are, as you say, which is a big theme here. They're the three children in the book, and they go to this house in Massachusetts to an old aunt who has invited Franny to come on her 17th birthday, and their aunt tells them the story of a cousin named Maggie. Right?
Yes,
and Maggie betrayed the family and told the locals this family of mysterious folks who may or may not be witches should be incarcerated. And Maggie was thrown out of the house, right?
Right. So, Maggie was very disloyal.
Yeah. So Aunt Isabel tells the story of Maggie, and that's what you're going to read for us right now, right? Okay. Go ahead.
Maggie Owens was so enraged when she was cast out onto the sidewalk with her suitcase that she took up cursing. And with every curse, she grew smaller and smaller. Some spells work against you, or perhaps the Owens cousins inside the house threw up a black reversing mirror. Each wicked word that Maggie spoke was turned back upon her. She couldn't even unlatch the lock on the door. Whatever magic ran through her blood had evaporated. She denied who she was, and when that happens, it's easy enough to become something else entirely. Most likely, the first creature that you see, which in her case was a rabbit darting through the garden. Maggie went to sleep in the grass a woman and awoke as a rabbit. Now she ate weeds and drank milk that was left to her in a saucer. Keep your eyes open, Isabel told the siblings. You may see her in the yard. This is what happens when you repudiate who you are. And once you do that, life works against you, and your fate is no longer your own.
Right. Alice Hoffman reading from her new novel, The Rules of Magic. You know, there is several mentions in the book about fate.
Yeah.
And trying to escape fate. What are you trying to say about fate in this book, do you think?
Well, fate is a funny thing, and I'm always trying to figure out if we're fated to have the lives that we have, if we can change them, if one small action changes everything else. But I think this book is really about, even if you're fated, you can still fight it. You can still fight for the life that you want to have.
Hmm. Also in this book, the children go to Salem, Massachusetts,
yes,
to Aunt Isabel, right? And there's a lot of history there about what happened in Massachusetts through several generations. How much of that's based on fact?
A lot of it's based on fact. You know, it's funny, in both books, people are always trying to escape from Massachusetts, and they can't. They have to come home.
Maybe there's your personal part of the book.
Maybe. I don't know. But, you know, yes, there's a lot of it is about what happened in Salem, although Salem's never mentioned by name. And the Hawthorne family is very tied up with the plot of this book. And Nathaniel Hawthorne's relative was one of the judges at the witchcraft trials.
Right.
And the one judge who never apologized or never admitted that he was wrong. So it's an interesting combination of families.
Right. And why witchcraft and witches in both of your books?
Yeah. Well, I think the witch is really an iconic female figure. And I think all little girls, if given the opportunity on Halloween, dress up as a witch. And there's a reason for that. And I think, you know, witches are very powerful, and they are, I can't really think of another kind of mythic figure that's female, that's as powerful, that has strength and is kind of alone in some way, but still has strength.
Hmm. There's also in the book, speaking of research, there's a lot of mention of, you know, you talk about the reversing mirror, right, in the passage that you just read from the book. But then there's a lot about spells and different herbs and lavender and all kinds of things that can be used for ailments or for spell casting or for whatever you like. I mean, was there research that also went into that, not just historic research? But
Yes, I have a huge magic library. And what's interesting is that magic and folk medicine are so interwoven. They're really pretty much one and the same.
Hmm. What surprised you most when you were researching that and that you included? I know you've included some put some things in the book a few times. Why was that? What fascinated you about certain things?
Well, I love the way it was belonged to women, really, this folk magic, that it was like being a midwife or being an herbalist, or, you know, that this really was a female domain. And I think that really just really appealed to me, that sense of solidarity amongst women.
Hmm. When you said sometimes the writer is the last to know, I mean, do you find that when you start writing something, it kind of takes on a life of its own and it just comes? I mean, I described the whole idea and the process of putting a novel out like this.
Yeah, well, I think that with every novel, there's an outer story and an inner story. And the outer story is all the outlines that you make up and all the research and all the plans that you have. But then there's an inner story that you don't really know. And in writing the book, you find out the answer to the question that you originally had. You find out the inner story. And sometimes I do think that the writer's the last to know. I was not sure really what the book was about, the heart of the book. I mean, I knew what it was about, that it was about these siblings that, you know, went to Massachusetts and discovered who they were and had difficulty accepting who they were, as many of us do. But really, it was about hope and the hope that you could change your fate and that you could find love.
And so what's next for you?
Well, I'm not sure. You know, I'm
is there a book coming to you? Even maybe the last to know again?
Well, actually, I'm having a book come out next year with my cousin Lisa Hoffman called Fairy Knitting. She's a master knitter. And so I wrote the fairy tales and she made the patterns that went with the fairy tales. So that's the next book.
Yeah. But is there another one that's coming to you that you're writing at the moment?
Yeah, there is. But, you know, I always feel like I can't talk about it because you never know if a book's going to come alive until it's really done.
Hmm. And tell me, I'm just so fascinated by that process. When do you finally realize, like, it's going to make it and this is going to be the inner story that might not have been clear to me at the outset? Is there are you halfway through, or do you have to wait to the end, or how does it happen?
I don't know. I think it's different every time. And I think there comes a time where it just feels like, okay, this is it. It's alive. And sometimes it's not, and you just have to move on to another book. How it actually happens after the notes and the researching and the different drafts, the real core of it, how it really happens, I have no idea. For me, that's magic.
Right. All right. Well, that's great. Well, keep us posted so we'll know what you're doing next.
Alice
Hoffman's new book is titled The Rules of Magic. It's a prequel to her best-selling novel, Practical Magic. She'll be speaking tonight at Temple Sinai in Marblehead, or you can see her on Halloween at the Brattle Theater in Cambridge. You can find more information about those events at our website, radioboston.org. Alice Hoffman, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And stay with us. Coming up, we'll talk sports with Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, it's Wednesday, so time for our weekly sports segment with Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Welcome back, Bill.
Hi, Deb.
So Game 2 of the World Series is tonight at Dodger Stadium in Los Angeles. Dodgers currently leading that series after winning last night 3-1. And the Dodgers took the lead early, very first pitch, actually. The Dodgers' Chris Taylor says he swung at the first ball he saw. Let's listen.
I think a lot of times, as it is with progress, what's significant about it is that they just looked at Alex Cora as the best man for the job. They didn't say, okay, we have to have a minority manager. Somebody like Alex Cora can be the odds-on favorite and get the job.
Okay, obviously.
We're in Boston, and the most important story is that the Red Sox have a new manager. So,
the
great gods of radio preempted your question and answered with the Red Sox.
Anyway, Chris Taylor was not Chris Taylor, but is this what we expected from the World Series matchup, Bill?
You don't expect a guy to hit a home run on the first pitch because the postseason is all about pitching. And once we got past that, you got a very tight game. You did have a two-run homer a little bit later on. I think you're going to see more of the same tonight. You're going to see Justin Verlander pitching for Houston. He was spectacularly effective against the Yankees. I think that the old cliche about pitching meaning everything in the postseason is likely to continue to be what we see.
Hmm. Both teams, would you say, how do you describe them? What are their relative strengths?
Well, first of all, you don't get to the World Series on a series of flukes for the most part, especially the way things are set up now with the, playoff levels of playoff baseball. Hmm. You got to beat good teams to get there. Mm-hmm. And so these are two very good teams. There's, the Indians were the third team that had a spectacularly good regular season. But both these teams had magnificent regular seasons, and they're set up to play a great series. And I, myself, always root for seven games. So
and
that's what I'm hoping
for. It does always seem to be seven.
No, it doesn't.
It does.
Sometimes,
sometimes
when the Red Sox win the World Series, like one year the Cardinals didn't show up and the Red Sox beat them four straight. So it can happen that way too. But I root for seven games, and so I root for Verlander to be as strong tonight as he was against the Yankees. He put 16 innings against the Yankees. He allowed one run, which is really quite exceptional. And I hope it'll be good and even the series up tonight.
Okay. Well, let's go to that big story now. The new manager of the Boston Red Sox, Alex Cora, was chosen, former Red Sox player,
yep,
chosen
briefly
as manager, right? And after the series, he will take over, presumably, as manager of the Red Sox. How significant is this move to have Alex Cora as the new manager?
I think it's significant for a number of reasons. One is that the Red Sox, of course, have a very long tradition of white, good old boy type candidates.
And he's the first Hispanic.
He's the first Hispanic. Mm-hmm. As many people have already noted, it's tremendously useful to speak Spanish these days because so many players in the major leagues are Hispanic, and some of them come in with excellent command of English and some of them don't. And it's great to be able to communicate easily and comfortably with the ones who don't necessarily speak great English. He hasn't been a major league manager before, but everything that you hear about the way he worked with players in Houston is very positive. So I'm all for it. I think it's great. It was kind of too bad that Farrell got fired because basically he got fired because his team lost to a better team in the playoffs. Mm. But I guess the sense in the front office was that he'd lost the team, and that's why they make a change.
What do you think are the main challenges facing Alex Cora? A lot of folks say, he was a player for a while. He might know some of these guys. It might be hard for him to take a leadership role.
Yeah, and he's a young guy, not a lot older than a lot of the players that he'll be managing. But I think he's probably earned their respect. And I think if the Red – it's a small community, and the Red Sox know guys on the Astros and players move around, and I think he probably has a very good reputation.
Dustin Pedroia, speaking of Red Sox, he had surgery today on his knee, and I think they said he might be out for 50 games. How's that going to affect things?
Yeah, the first thing I thought when I heard this story that Pedroia had knee surgery was this is a guy who, by all accounts, will be the hardest working, most diligent rehabber in the history of knee surgery. He's everything about him says that he's a tough guy and he can't wait to get back on the field. And so if anybody can make a successful 100% recovery from this sort of thing, he'd be the guy who could do it.
Mm. Talking about injuries, Gordon Haywood, who broke his ankle. I know.
I didn't watch it. People told me not to watch it, and I said, okay, I won't.
Probably a good idea. He broke his ankle in the first quarter of his debut with the Celtics last week. He's had surgery. Do we know how he's doing?
The initial report was that he had come through surgery very well. And, of course, this is another story of somebody who's going to have to rehab like crazy. I mean, this is a really serious injury. And and diligence will have something to do with it, and luck will have something to do with it, and we can only wish him the best, and then turn our attention to, as is always necessary in these circumstances, what the Celtics do to try to patch up the team and carry on.
Mm. And it kind of overshadowed Kyrie Irving's debut.
Oh, absolutely.
The team.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that was gruesome. I mean, you saw the photographs of players, even opposing players, looking away and putting towels over their heads. And I think that's very obviously because it's a terrible reminder of how quickly the career that you've worked to establish since you were probably 10, 11, 12 years old can be interrupted by something utterly out of your control in an instant.
Right. Okay, Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Bill, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Deb.
This is the music of Glenn Miller, the Chattanooga Choo Choo, and it's considered a prime example of how the sounds of trains influenced jazz music. Today, we want to revisit one of our conversations that we had with Rob Capello. He's a conductor, composer, and author, and he joined us earlier this year to tell us why trains and their sounds are so important to jazz music.
You know, at first I had absolutely no idea what the answer to that question was. And not only did I have no answer, I had never actually thought about it. You know, but then I came across this incredible book. You know, normally my programs begin with music that I'm interested in. But this one began with a book or an idea. And this book was called Railroads and the African American Experience, written in 2010. And I thought, wow, this seems like an interesting topic. And all of a sudden I started to realize the enormous influence of railroads on the African-American experience. I mean, they literally built the railroads in the pre-Civil War South. I mean, almost all of the employment in the South came through these railroads. And then there's a great line in this book where he talks about how it had massive influence on travel, culture, employment, and also music as well. And all these work songs and spirituals were about trains. And not only that, the train kind of became a metaphor for either going to heaven. Half of the songs, you were going to heaven in the blues songs. Half of them, you were going to hell. And of course, we all know Take the A Train. Right. And the more I started to realize that these trains were part of everything, I started to see there were hundreds of jazz songs. And the more you read about their lives, you realized also those trains literally made the lives of these big swing bands popular because they would go from town to town by the railroad trains. And most of these musicians would spend most of their lives on the trains having these sounds in their heads. And in the case of Duke Ellington's band, I mean, the only way you could travel safely in the South, since all the housing was segregated, was to have your own train. So literally, when they would go through the South, they would live on the trains. And what's in your consciousness actually becomes part of your music.
Well, let's just go back a little bit to the song we started with. Before we
Can you still remember that song?
Before we get to Duke Ellington.
You got me started. The book is 500 pages. Don't get me started.
Let's talk about Chattanooga Choo Choo. Walk me through the music a little bit here.
Well, you know, it's interesting. So this issue of how do you turn the train sounds into music, what do I call train onomatopoeia, so to speak. So now, I mean, he starts off with a simple idea. I mean, this doesn't sound much like a train. Not so much.
No.
Now, normally, if you were going to put some chords under it, you'd put some nice simple major chords like this. I mean, that would sound fine. But to make it sound like a train, he has every instrument do it starting on a different note. Here, 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 in this wonderful whole tone kind of sound. So instead of this, he does this. And it starts to sound a little bit like a train. And then the next thing, what does a train do next? Well, it leaves the station and it accelerates. So instead of going 1, 2, 3, 4, it goes double speed. 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. Then it goes quadruple speed, which is hard to say. 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. Same time, you've got swooping trombones. Wow, wow, I'm going choo, choo in a highly dissonant way. And then you have trumpets, who normally would play this. But to turn it into jazz and to turn it into a train, you do dissonance. And suddenly the sound of the trains is literally actually becoming jazz music. And if you put it together and you rehear that opening now, you'll hear that slow train, whole tone sound, getting faster and faster, swooping trombones being the train whistle, and then the jazz. Let's just hear that one little segment one more time. Here it is. Double time. Trombone. Quadruple time. Choo, choo. Trumpets. Now down a scale. Now clarity. And we're at our tune.
Right. And the lyrics. Now tell us a little bit. Okay, so now we've got the lyrics on top of all this to make it perfectly clear.
Absolutely.
In case there was any confusion. So describe that a little bit.
And, you know, the lyrics immediately give you a feeling of what civil rights situation was at the time. I mean, it's amazing how lyrics embed American history within them. You know, pardon me, boy. Mm. Is that the Chattanooga choo-choo? Then they go, yes, yes, track 29. Boy, you can give me a shine. I mean, in just those few lines, you get the whole situation of the South in the 1940s with luxury train travel in which white passengers are served by black Pullman porters and black shoeshine boys, which was almost the only regular employment that you could get at the time. And in just those few lines, you get the world of Plessy versus Ferguson, of separate but equal, mm-hmm. of segregated luxury train travel. And, you know, Plessy versus Ferguson was actually a case about a black person who refused to get off a white train.
So there's an awful lot going on there. But you also mentioned Duke Ellington as an example of how things are done a little bit differently. Explain that a little bit.
Well, you know, as I say, Duke Ellington probably wrote more famous train pieces than anyone. And I really do think it's because he had his own train and he absolutely lived on that train. But in Ellington's case, he takes the language of Glenn Miller and makes it even more dissonant and more abstract. And in one of his most famous pieces that we'll be playing with the fantastic Kyle, a Thade big band, by the way, one of this fantastic New York big bands. He starts off with this incredibly dissonant, abstract train chord for the piano, like this. And he plays it six times syncopated. Over and over again. I mean, it's a beautiful beginning. At the same time, in between, there's this bizarre double bass going. I mean, this is one of the weirdest ways to begin a piece. I mean, you know, normally you think of a piece beginning with like a nice stable frame with a chord, like it can go home to your mother, something like this. But no, it begins with this incredibly dissonant, abstract train whistle. And then it gets even worse. He has this great version. How do you make a chugging train? Now, you got to imagine him every night traveling on one of these night trains. And he takes something that, if it were Glenn Miller, might sound nice like this. But he does this wonderful dissonant version. He changes two notes in this chord. This is Glenn Miller, but he first changes it to this. But then he adds one dissonant note that makes it Duke Ellington. And now suddenly it's a steam train. Then the third chord, instead of being this, he changes to this. So this nice little Glenn Miller pattern comes this wonderful Duke Ellington pattern. And suddenly you've got this chugging pattern. Now, what's so amazing, it repeats over and over again 52 measures of the same thing. So you got to imagine this chugging train. On top, he puts these abstract, dissonant steam train sounds. And you get this wonderful combination of a night train ride interrupted by shrieks and train whistle blasts. Let's listen to a little bit of the beginning of this. And you'll hear layer after layer. You'll hear a simple trumpet going, but with some quick little grace notes that feel like blues. Not this, but over and over, low moaning trains. All on top of this repeated pattern, what we call an ostinato. Let's hear a little of that. Listen to that weird double bass.
Yeah.
Here we go. Night train ride, chugging train, trumpets. Low train whistles. This is an abstract train ride. The wailing saxophone on top. Train whistle plus blues.
I just love hearing you explain this.
Amazing music.
It is incredible. I mean, I'm learning so much here. I'm wondering if we could go out on something something fun, and you could tell us a little bit about this song from Count Basie.
Yeah, Count Basie. This is a great one because you've been hearing all these dissonant sounds. We should have something fun to listen to. Count Basie wrote one of the famous train songs called The Super Chief, which is actually the flagship train of the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railway. And here, unlike one of these slow ones, it's a fast express train streaking to Los Angeles, California.
That's author, composer, and conductor Rob Capello. He joined us back in January, and this is Count Basie's Super Chief. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, and Allison Bruzek, with help from Cassandra Sunt. Tim Skog is our technical director. We had engineering help today from Renee Marchando. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.